Now, you said in one of your emails that you have done quite a bit of research into the history of simultaneous interpreting, particularly, and earlier you said you wanted to become a practitioner first. So at some point, I suppose, the interest in research came back up, or how did that happen?
I always thought that I did not want to write yet another dissertation on the use of the definite article in something or other. And frankly, that was always my premise and my aversion to research.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Having seen too much of that type of. But then it so happened that a few years ago I stumbled across an archive that, and when I saw it, when I opened up those documents, I realized that I was looking at something extremely important to our profession. It was almost like stumbling across a treasure chest full of gold coins. What it was a digital archive of Edward Filleen, who was the founder of Filleen's department store and the chain Filleen's Basement in the U.S. until recently. It's now closed. But he was also the inventor, so to speak, of simultaneous interpreting systems back in the 1920s. And among other things, he was also a founder of the American Credit Union movement and the first chairman of the National Credit Union Association. So the archives of the Credit Union Association, CUNA, in Madison, Wisconsin, have this folder on the telephonic interpreting system that Filleen invented in the 20s. And then I started looking at those documents, and I saw the original patent that he took out for the Filleen-Finley interpreting system. I saw his correspondence with people like Thomas Edison, with Thomas Watson, the founder of IBM. Amazing things, you know, and the story, his interviews, or interviews with him, somebody at the League of Nations and at the ILO in the 30s, talking to him, and he retelling the history, the story of how he invented simultaneous interpreting, what led to it. And I thought, this is incredible. This is absolutely incredible. And but then I encountered, I found this book. I started reading on the subject. I read his biography. And then I found a book by Jesus Baigorri Jalón from Paris to Nuremberg, which at the time was available only in French and Spanish. It's now available in English. And I started looking at that book, and I said, oh, everything that I wanted to say is already said about this.
Too bad.
I got in touch with Jesus, and we started communicating by Skype regularly at some point. And he encouraged me to dig deeper into that research and to see what are the nuggets in that particular archive that we could find. And so I started doing that, and it at the same time led me to start to asking the question of what was happening in Russia, Soviet Russia, at that very same time in the 1920s, because so the story of Filleen and the League of Nations and the ILO is the Western story, and yet there was the Communist International, the Comintern, which was the nemesis of the League of Nations, and kind of existed at that very same time, and also functioned as an international organization, and also used interpretation and interpreters and simultaneous interpretation. And I remembered there was an article in one of the Russian interpreting translated journals in the 60s by Yevgeny Hoffman, who was one of the Soviet interpreters at Nuremberg, who briefly told the story of simultaneous interpreting in the USSR, where he mentioned that for the first time, simultaneous interpreting in the USSR was used at the 6th Congress of the Comintern in 1928, and that the newspaper Krasnaya Niva from that year shows a picture of interpreters wearing headphones, and that was just a brief mention of that. And it sort of, that quote was, you know, went around the different research articles on the history. Everybody was just kind of going back to that one sentence quote. But by then, you know, we're now in a different world, and you can actually go to the library, and unlike the Soviet times where you could not ever see old newspapers.
Oh, yeah.
For some reason they were classified.
Yeah.
Yes, not anymore. So, you know, a quick look in the library, of course, reveals the front page of Krasnaya Niva from 1928 with a very nice picture of an interpreter, no headphones, but a microphone around hanging around the person's neck, and an article, what was it, Technology at the Service of the Communist Revolution. First time in the world, it says. Simultaneous interpreters are speaking simultaneously with the speaker, interpreting into multiple languages at the 6th Congress of the Communist International, etc., etc. And so, of course, once you see this, you have to dig deeper, right? This is where curiosity really led me on an incredible journey with the help of my sister, who actually spent a lot of time in the archives, because I was only able to visit, you know, once every few months for a short time, and then kind of look at documents in a more pinpointed way. But she was the one doing the sifting through the myriads of documents that were there in the archives, and we saw pictures and documents about that time period, about interpretation, how it was organized. There was even some information about the Russian Filene, the very first inventor of simultaneous interpreting method and a proposed system in Russia. So if you think that the original method proposed by Filene was a little bit unusual by modern standards, because what he proposed in 1925 was to have an interpretation booth, interpreter sitting in the booth, but instead of interpreting from what the interpreter was hearing, it would be the stenographer who would be listening to the original, and the interpreter was supposed to be trained to read the stenographic notes.
Oh, I see.
And, so using that stenographer as a relay and then interpret. So this was the original, it was modified, but that was the original idea proposed by Filene. So if you think that was a little bit strange, imagine how strange the Russian proposal was. It was proposed by a physician, a medical doctor by the name of Epstein, who suggested that you would have a three interpreter method of simultaneous. So you would have three booths, one interpreter in each, and each interpreter only takes care of a very small segment of what the interpreter hears. So the speech begins, and the first sentence is interpreted by interpreter one in booth A consecutively. So the interpreter listens to the chunk that he is comfortable receiving, then switches on a light or a buzzer, which signals the interpreter in the next booth to start listening, all the while the interpreter in the first booth is interpreting, and then the second interpreter finishes listening to his chunk, passes on the relay to the third interpreter, and by that time the first interpreter will have finished his or her segment, the second interpreter starts, and then the third interpreter starts, and then goes back to the first one. So,
interesting.
Sort of simultaneous, with each of them doing consecutive. of very short segments. Now, I can imagine that once they tested it, it did not work that way either, because by 1928, everything converged to a very different method, pretty much similar to the modern chuchotage, if you will. And then it developed further on, and it's interesting to learn when the first interpretation booths started appearing. And I actually have an amazing photograph from the Moscow archives, interpretation booths that date back to 1934, and they look like canvas tents, huge funnel microphone that the interpreter speaks into, no earphones again, but the shape, the shell shape of the booth that's facing the podium kind of channels the sound into it, because they're in the first row, in the front row, and they're interpreting into these funnel microphones to not to interfere with each other. But and we even got to the archives of radio and television and found footage. So it's not just photos, it's also moving pictures. And I have created a presentation out of it, which I did at the ATA conference in Miami in 2015, then recently in New York for the Nuremberg Expo, Birth of the Profession. And so I'm really taking this show on the road, because I think that one thing is to, and I did also write a chapter in a book, this New Insights in the History of Interpreting, that Jesús Orihalón and Kiyoko Takeda edited. And so I have a chapter in there, and it's called At the Dawn of Simultaneous Interpreting in the USSR. But how many copies of Benjamin's literature are sold around the world? You know, not many, to be honest. And I think it's important to popularize that history, because even interpreters nowadays, a lot of them think that simultaneous started at Nuremberg. Going back to the roots, to the early history, I think is very important, because this is when we really learn our roots, where we came from, why conference interpreting became simultaneous interpreting. You know, the introduction of multiple languages, you know, the democratization of international conferences at the turn of the century. Basically, after the Paris Peace Conference, right, at the end of World War I, this is really the start of conference interpreting in the modern 20th century sense of the world, of the word. And who knows, you know, maybe it was the profession of the 20th century, and maybe we're now seeing, you know, the tail end of it. Who knows?
Yeah, but I think you're completely right, because I did look into it a little bit for a talk I gave two years ago. So I think, and I found it striking that, I mean, this was more about the Comintern and Nuremberg as well. And I tried to show that, especially the people at Nuremberg, actually, it was a very tough job for them, not only because the technology wasn't as good as it is today, but also because some of them had been, you know, victims, or they had lost family members to the Nazis, and they still had to interpret that day in and day out for weeks and months. And I saw some similarities to nowadays, that people refuse to even engage with new technological developments. And of course, back at the day, as you know, there were many people who said, well, simultaneous will never work, and they are just, you know, telephonists. And they had these bad words for these people that actually, as you rightfully said, sort of almost created a new profession, or brought the profession to a whole new level. So I found that there were a few interesting parallels. But what I was wondering, we know quite a bit about Filene and Finlay and the other people involved. And you mentioned this Mr. Epstein, and he was a medical doctor. Do we know more about him and why he did this? And were there any other people involved that we know something about nowadays?
We know about him. Well, we really know very little about Epstein. I'm going to use the Russian way of pronouncing his name. Just to, you know, differentiate him from all the other Epsteins and Epsteins.
There are a few, yes.
So Epstein, we know he was a physician, because at the time, the term doctor could not be associated, the title of doctor could not be associated with a doctor of philosophy or a academic degree as we have now. At the time in Russia, those people would be called professor. And so the only person who could have the title of doctor could be a medical doctor. And from that kind of realization, I tried to look in the archives of the medical world at that same time, and we found that a medical doctor with the same initials, V. Epstein, was working for the Kremlin Polyclinic, so the Kremlin Hospital. And it is my theory that he might have been stationed at the Comintern congresses as part of the little on-site, you know, emergency medical unit for delegates.
Yeah.
And he would be observing what was happening with consecutive interpretation the same way as Philine was observing consecutive.
Yeah. At the League of Nations.
Geneva, yeah. Right. And being very frustrated with the slowness of the process. Again, the very same ideas are echoing in his memo to the Executive Committee of the Comintern from 1925, precisely the same week as Philine sends his letter to the General Secretary of the League of Nations.
Coincidence.
And echoing exactly the same issues with consecutive. And proposing a system and method that would speed it up, that would use technology, that would turn this into a very different thing. And so he, just like Philine, was working with Finley, who was his engineer, the same way Epstein was working with an engineer by the name of Goron. So Goron was a young engineer at the Moscow Telephone Exchange, and he was tasked with helping implement Epstein's system in actual life. But Garon is a very known historical figure, actually. There's a Wikipedia article about him. He is known mostly to our colleagues in the audiovisual world because he was he ended up being the sort of the father of Soviet hi-fi systems, if you will. You know, the first tape recorders, the LP records, Melodia factory that produced LP records in the Soviet Union. So he founded that. He founded also a recording studio on Moscow Radio, and there were so he was the father of radio. He was also behind the Soviet wired radio, which was something that it was like every Russian house or apartment had a little radio unit that was plugged into the wall. And that would be switched on automatically at 6 o'clock in the morning with the national anthem. And people would wake up with it, and people would go to sleep with it.
I didn't know that.
It was also the same type of wired radio that was also installed outside in the streets with the huge loudspeakers. So if you can imagine that. So this was that. So Garon was, behind that technology. And again, when you start reading his biography, there's always a line somewhere that in 1928 he was in charge of developing the first Soviet system for simultaneous interpreting at the Comintern, and yet nobody paid attention to it. I guess nobody from our world, from the interpreting world, ever looked at it from that perspective or had the interest of looking into his biography. But so I tried to, and he passed away not so long ago in the late 80s, and there were still people who were his students because he taught at the Moscow Radio Electrical Institute, and there were his students who are still alive, of course, and I got in touch with one of them who is now the chair of that department, who said, yes, well, Garon explained to us when we were students how he put that system together, and he worked with Epstein, who was a physician, a medical doctor, and he confirmed that.
Oh. So that closes the circle.
That completed the circle. Unfortunately, we know really very little about Epstein. And there's one photo, which actually I have also in my book, in my chapter, of three people standing in front of this unit, which is, I guess, the sound rack for the interpretation system and testing the sound. And one of them, I believe, is Epstein, but it's not entirely clear. So hopefully, we'll, you know, in time, we will be able to find more information about him. But at this point, it seems like we've hit a dead end a little bit.
But do you still have archive material, or do you still have resources that are not, that you haven't gone through, that you're still working on, or is this it now?
I think this is it for the Russian part. But there's another interesting branch, which you might be interested in, that started developing quite recently. As I was looking at Filene's correspondence on the acquisition of patents for his system, before he sold his invention to IBM, he wanted to make sure that he got patents for it. And he took out the U.S. patent, and he took out patents in Switzerland and France. And then when it came to Germany, the German patent office wrote back to him saying, well, we cannot give you a patent because we already have something like this.
Oh.
Yes. And what was it? It was the Siemens Halske system. Siemens Halske AG, right? Mm-hmm. That system was used in 1930, if I'm not mistaken, the Second World Power Congress in Berlin. And it might have been the first time when it was used there. And I have some material about that. But the interesting thing is that Elke Limberger, I don't know if you know her, they call it,
think of it,
the name, yeah. Also behind the Nuremberg Expo project, the birth of the profession. I wrote that to her, that little piece from, because I had a little exchange with the chief historian of Siemens, mm-hmm. and I received some technical specifications of that particular system. But then she and her colleague, I guess, went to the Siemens archives to explore deeper. And there is now correspondence from Siemens, from Mr. Siemens himself, to Filene, telling him that their company started looking at this from 1918, much, much earlier. So we're tracing this back to 1925. And now this is 1918. So who knows? I mean, this history keeps being pushed back further and further. This is something that needs to be explored. I mean, I don't speak German at all, so it's definitely not for me to do it, but other colleagues, I'm sure, should go and explore this, because this is just another wave. I was looking at it as the Russian-American kind of thing, but it's not just that. So there's the German connection as well.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's a bit like genealogy, because I've done this for a while and looked into family history, and then you keep digging and you find another link and you go back even earlier and earlier and earlier. But it's extremely fascinating. Absolutely.
It's like the thing they used to say about Russia during Perestroika. It was quite a famous saying at the time, that many countries have unpredictable future, but Russia has unpredictable past.
Yeah.